Blog Talk Radio.
Now, in its second edition, Carol Dean's popular book, The Art of Film Funding, has 12 new chapters to cover all areas of film financing and how to avoid expensive pitfalls. Learn how to start with an idea and end with a trailer. How to make an ask for money. Create your story structure and your trailer. Legal advice. Fair use. Successful crowdfunding. How to ask for music rights. And what insurance you can't shoot without. Available on Amazon under Carol Dean and at FromTheHeartProductions.com.
Hi, and welcome to The Art of Film Funding. I'm your co-host, Claire Papan, along with Carol Dean, author of the best-selling book, The Art of Film Funding. Carol is also the founder and president of From the Heart Productions and the host of this show. Our guest, Beth Harrington, is an independent producer, director, and writer. She often focuses on work that explores American history, music, and culture. Her film, Welcome to the Club, The Women of Rockabilly, about the pioneering of women of rock and roll, was honored with a 2003 Grammy nomination. In a previous lifetime, she was a rock and roll singer. Beth has recently completed The Winding Stream, The Carters, The Cashes, and The Course of Country Music. Carol, Beth was also one of the winners of the Roy Dean Film Grant for The Winding Stream, right?
Yes, and we're so proud to be a part of this film. Thank you for joining us today, Beth.
Oh, thank you, Carol. It's really fun to be here and to be talking with you again.
Well, we want to hear all about this film because it is fantastic. There's so many special, extraordinary things about the film, but let's start with the first one being that you have the last interview with Johnny Cash, and I'd love to know how you achieved that.
Well, it was through an interesting sort of circuitous route. I had done a film, my film that Claire had mentioned in the introduction, Welcome to the Club, which is a film about women rockabilly singers. In the course of doing that film, I was looking for an authoritative music voice to be the narrator of that film. And I thought Roseanne Cash would be a perfect fit, being a woman in music and also the daughter of a famous rockabilly singer himself. Johnny Cash, when he started, was a rockabilly singer. So I asked her to do it, and Roseanne and I got to be friendly. And when I, in the course of working with her and working on that film, I realized, you know, there's this whole untold story about the Carters and the relationship to the Cash family, to Johnny Cash and to June Carter Cash. So I kind of got up the courage to ask Roseanne if she'd help me make that film, if, you know, she would make some introductions for me. And one of the primary introductions was with her dad. And so that was how I got in the door. And he was incredibly gracious and really funny. And it was just a great thing to do. And it was just a memorable interview for me.
Oh, my gosh, and for all of us. I mean, he is so spiritual. I know he always was, but at the end of his life, he became even more open with that spirituality. And you could just see how close he was to God in this interview. I mean, when he spoke, you felt like that you had to hang on to every word because it was so special.
Yeah, that's true. That's the impression. Sitting with him is definitely that feeling, like he's looking right at you, and he's intently focused on you, and that he was weighing everything very carefully and wanting to make sure that, you know, he honored the Carters and honored this sense he had of the spirit in their family. So yeah, it was exactly like that.
And when in that interview, when he said, and I think it was he who said that Maybelle was out there, that after they stopped touring with the music, she went back to work as a nurse, and he said, "That's how could she be going working as a nurse when she's one of the best musicians we ever had?"
That's right. Yeah, I mean, his love of June Carter is well documented, but what isn't well documented is his love for his mother-in-law. And his relationship to Maybelle Carter, I would argue, is as important as his relationship to June. And she, Maybelle, really intently helped him and her husband Ezra also helped Johnny Cash at really critical times in his life. And he was already a fan before he became involved with the family and married into the family, but after he had the opportunity to tour with Maybelle and the sisters, he says in the film, she was the most VIP of the VIPs, and then he said, and I've seen them all. And he really had, you know.
Yes. Oh, that was so true. I have to tell you that when I talked to this, my aunt who lives in Texas and loves rock, she loves Johnny Carter, Johnny Cash and all the Carter family and mm-hmm. Willie and the whole thing. That's how she spends a lot of her time is listening to recorded country western music. Mm-hmm. And so she said, well, it's Maybelle. You got to get that story. She's the one. She was the head of that family. And I thought, how did she know that?
No. Well, you know, people who follow the Carters really do understand. I mean, it's funny because Maybelle wasn't a flashy person, and she wasn't, by today's standards as a music person, she was very low-key. But she was such an authoritative player. She was so great on her guitar. And she invented stuff on acoustic guitar that people still play nowadays and probably don't even recognize that it came from her. And because she wasn't touted the same way that some musicians are these days. So, but the real diehard fans know that about her and know what an important role she had in the music. So, I'm not surprised your aunt knows if she's a fan. I'm sure she knows that, you know, Maybelle was the guitarist, and she popularized guitar in country music when it wasn't the main instrument in country music. You know,
this is an unusual fact. Was she one of the first to bring the guitar on with the soloist?
Yeah, she really was. She was at the time, guitar was in the 20s, 1920s, guitar was treated almost like a percussion instrument, like somebody was playing a rhythm behind the fiddle player or the banjo player, or, you know, those instruments were more prominent. And when Maybelle and AP, her brother-in-law, and her cousin Sarah all got together, Sarah was playing some auto harp and singing, and AP just sang, very rarely played anything. So a great burden of the carrying the music depended on Maybelle. And so Maybelle became this person who figured out how to play rhythm and lead at the same time so she could fill in the blanks, essentially. So that's why she's so pivotal, because she invented a style that now we hear all the time and we take it for granted, but not many people had done what she was doing at the time.
Oh, that's brilliant, and you really get that across in your film, Beth.
Oh, thanks.
So now let's go to how A.P. Carter went into the hills and brought back songs, because that's a fascinating story.
He was an amazing character. I mean, AP was very quirky and also, you know, I think obsessed is not too strong a word. Obsessed with music. He just loved music. And even before there was any real reason to do so, he would go off in the hills and wander around and meet people at their homes and sit on front porches and learn songs from people. And this was at a time that you're just starting to see some of the really serious musicologists coming to the South and collecting songs. But AP was doing it just out of his own interest. He wasn't a professor. He wasn't, you know, a musicologist. He was just a guy who loved the music. But when it started to come in handy was when they got their break and started recording for Victor Talking Machine Records. And when they started doing that, their manager, record label owner, Ralph Peer, said, we need more songs. And so for AP, that was easy. He knew how to do that. He'd go out and he'd meet people and he'd pick up songs. So it was a really interesting move on his part. And it made the Carta catalog so important because he was not only writing material, but he was collecting songs that probably would have been lost to history otherwise.
Oh, I know. And you showed that so well in your film. I just have this vision of this guy unloading his pockets, and every pocket had something scribbled on it that was part of
a song.
But he really saved all those songs, didn't he?
That's right. That's right. And the other interesting thing about him is that at one point in his career, he started traveling with an African-American man named Leslie Riddle, who is a blues player from a nearby town from where AP and the other Carters lived. And so he was sort of in an interesting, you know, a relationship that probably at the time in the South would have been considered unusual, to say the least. He and Leslie Riddle would travel around and collect songs together. And Leslie Riddle was able to open doors for him in various communities that AP might have not had access to otherwise, the African-American communities around the South. So a lot of the Carta catalog is also based in the music of the African-American communities in the South because of Leslie Riddle's involvement.
Oh, that was lovely. And I bet that was unusual to see a black and a white man driving around together sitting in a car.
Yeah.
In the 20s, yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, I always think we owe him so much because I know that AP didn't have a lot of money, and there he was going up in the hills, probably sleeping in his car, eating peanut butter sandwiches. And
Yeah, no, it's true. I mean, they would be gone for long periods of time. He would think nothing of going off for, you know, weeks at a time to do this. And, you know, obviously he deeply enjoyed it as well, but it is an incredible service to music that he was able to collect so much material. And the other thing about it is some of what he collected was fragmentary. He would pick up a chorus he liked or a line of poetry he saw in a book that someone had or, you know, a little melody line that he liked. And then he and Leslie would go back and teach what they'd gotten to Sarah and Maybelle, and then it became a whole other platform for them. They start reworking material. So a lot of these songs only have a passing resemblance to the original material. Some of them is really, you know, something they created out of the bits and pieces of what AP brought back. Sometimes they were full songs, but sometimes they were these creations that the Carters and with Leslie Riddle's help put together. So it's a real interesting process that they had.
Yes. Well, you sent me a screener to look at the film, and I had it on my coffee table. So I had a bunch of friends over, and one of the people plays guitar.
Oh,
so
nice.
I think you might like this film, but it's a documentary, and everybody's face was looking at me like, oh, please, you got to be kidding.
So, you still get a bad rap in the documentary world.
I know, and so I said, okay, 20 minutes, give me 20 minutes. And they said, okay, where's the beer? Fix me a drink. Okay. Well, 20 minutes goes by, and I say, okay, how about I'll turn it off? No, they said, don't touch that.
Oh, that's great.
They loved it. They said, I didn't know documentaries could be so much fun and so interesting.
Well, that's good. That's a service right there, I guess. If people will stay open to documentaries, I'm proud.
Yeah. And well, you telling such a good story, and the people you highlighted, we got to know them, Beth. I felt like I knew all of them. And who was the sister, Maybelle's sister that moved to California? Oh, she was married to AP, and she said that's it. When he went off and left her for in the wintertime with no firewood and several children.
Right. Yeah. When that was the downside of AP's song collecting, is that he left his wife Sarah, who is the third member of the Carter family trio. He left Sarah back in Mesa Springs with not a lot of help. And so, you know, he'd be gone for long periods of time, and she got really resentful, as you might imagine. So it was in service to the music, but Sarah was never as enamored with the music as the other two were, even though she was a fantastic singer and really created the Carter song sound rather with her voice. She wasn't just into the music business, as it were, at the time. So, yeah, she was very resentful. And the bad part, of course, is that when AP went to remedy that, he thought, well, I'll ask my cousin Coy to check in on Sarah and have her help, have him help around the house. And unfortunately, Coy did help around the house. And eventually, AP and Sarah were divorced because Sarah and Coy had fallen in love. So
right.
That was a miscalculation on everyone's part, I guess. But that ended up being the beginning of the end for the Carter family as a musical group, in a way. But it took another 10 years for it to really shake out. But that was the beginning of it.
Right. Well, the photos were fantastic.
Oh,
so
thank you.
How did you find all these great photos? Did you use an archivist.
Yep. It was a combination of a couple things. Back in the day when I was coming up in the film world, I used to do archival research. So I started the process by myself because at the beginning I didn't have enough money to pay anybody else. So I did some of that. I also enlisted the help of a really great friend of mine, Kathleen O'Connell, who is an archivist, and she's a producer now, but she found some of the initial footage that we had. A good part of it, though, we owe thanks to the Carter family themselves. Both John Carter Cash and the family in Virginia have a real treasure trove of material that they were happy to share with us, which was really nice. So I spent a good part of 2 days in the family vault at John Carter Cash's house looking at photos of John and June and the Carters, and it was the kind of thing you just never really wanted to leave. There was so much good stuff to look at. And then I also had the help of another archivist here in Portland where I live, named Alana Saul, and she did tremendous work because a lot of what happened with this film, and I think this happens for a lot of filmmakers now, is that my editor got excited about finding things online. You know, he'd see an image of Johnny Cash that he liked and he'd pluck it off, you know, the internet and put it in the film with the idea that at some point we were going to have to track down who owned that picture and who we had to pay. But over the course of the years, that became blurrier and blurrier. So when we finally had to pay up, I enlisted Alana's help, and she was able to do this incredible detective work tracking down who owned some of the photos that were in question. And so we were able to, you know, get that all resolved. But it was a lot of detective work in some ways on both ends, you know.
Wow, I can imagine. Well, the animation in your film is outstanding. Just so everyone understands, she has these great pictures of the people who are singing, but it's a still picture. But with animation, their eyes are blinking and their mouths are blinking, and you think they're singing. It is so. So tell us who your animator was.
The animator is a great guy, also here in Portland, named Mike Olson. And Mike does a lot of really charming, a little quirky even, our work with archival materials. And I found him through another friend, and he relished the challenge of bringing the Carters to life, because the problem with a film that dates back to, or story that dates back to the 20s, is that there is a lot of film footage of these folks. In fact, with the Carters, there's no footage of AP, Sarah, and Maybelle together in those early years. And there's almost nothing later on either. We have footage of Sarah and Maybelle in the 1960s or the 1940s on up, but we don't have anything of AP. So we knew, you know, it's a movie, it needs movement. So Mike was up for the challenge, and we gave him lots of, again, Alana helped with this, our archivist. She found great photo elements to help illustrate the story. So when you see the Carters performing in the film, they're doing their audition in Tennessee, And they're in a warehouse, so we had to find a great old photo of a warehouse. And then we have the old microphone pop up and blankets. We've sort of flopped down in the frame because that's what they used for sound baffling in those days. And it was a fun challenge, and both Alana and Mike worked really well together, and they made these beautiful animated pieces where you see the Carters driving into their audition and driving home afterwards, and, you know, a lot of fun stuff, and I'm really glad you liked it. It's a little quirky, but I think it really works. So
it does work, and it adds so much value to the film.
Oh, thanks.
I don't know what your budget is, but I would, from looking at as many films as I have, I'd think it was close to $2 million.
Well, that's nice, because it's a fraction of that. I think it's it'd be a sixth of that. Is that right? Yeah, something like that. Yeah. Yeah,
good.
We didn't. It was kind of a shoestring effort in a lot of ways, and that's one of the reasons it took a while to make. But I'm glad the production value looks like that. That's great.
It looks great. Well, now most people I know say, "Oh, I'm going to do a film with music in it." Then they start checking on the rights and all the complications and the fair use, and they back off.
Yeah.
So, how did you handle the music rights? And did you have a music supervisor?
We do have a music supervisor, and I also did a lot of legwork on that end myself because I wanted to make sure. This is a little unusual, this film, because not only are there music rights in it, but one of the music rights holders is, in fact, part of the film, and that's Peer Publishing. So Peer Publishing is a major, it's called Peer Music now, and it's a major music publisher in the world. It's huge. But their founder, Ralph Peer, was the guy who discovered the Carters. So Ralph Peer is in the film, and the music, all of the music in the film, with a couple of exceptions, is a Peer Publishing composition. So early on, we started conversations with Peer because we wanted to make sure that this was all doable. And of course, they were, they've been very helpful, and they really... you know, this is their story, too, in a way. So we were able to establish with them that we weren't a big-budget film. So, you know, that part has been really good. The other issue, of course, with music rights is that you're not just paying for one set of rights. You're paying for multiple sets of rights. So you're also paying for performances sometimes, and you're definitely paying for the recordings. And we used a lot of Carter Family recordings, and those are owned these days by Sony. So we're still working on some of that. I mean, we're not totally out of the woods, but we know that it's all doable and happening. But it's not cheap, and it can be really daunting. And you know, sometimes the publishing can be, you know, in the $3,000 a song realm. And if you're like our film and you have 30 songs in the film, that adds up. So. It's been really a lot of what I've been preparing for with this film is knowing that the day would come when we had a big price tag on the music, and that never left my mind. And I think most filmmakers, you know, need to keep that in furthermost in their mind too, because it's not something that you can address at the end, short of taking the music out. And I know that's painful for a lot of filmmakers. So,
right. Well,
yeah.
So when you say you're doing it in stages, can you tell me how or what that means?
Well, we're, because everything is so expensive, what we're doing is having both these entities, all the entities involved, break things down for us in terms of what would it cost to do festivals, what would it cost to do theatrical, what would it cost to do video on demand, you know, and seeing. Frankly, seeing how much money we have right now that we can apply to those different stages. I mean, the ideal thing would be able to, most of these companies want to do, if you want all rights in perpetuity, then you have to plop down the money all at once. And, you know, most of us independent filmmakers just don't have that kind of money in the coffers. So it becomes more of an issue of, look, can we break it down? Can we do festivals and see what transpires after the festivals, then, you know, can we raise a little more money and do this level? And, it's a kind of a grueling process, but it's the reality, I think. So that's kind of what we're looking at, is doing, seeing if we can clear certain stages, and then, as you know, as much as possible with what we have in the bank, and then see about raising the rest of it, because the fundraising doesn't end in these films.
Well, that's quite true. That is a very good way to do it, I would say, because if you pay the money for the festivals, then you find someone in the festival that wants to take you to the next stage. They will be able to come up with the money you need for the music to take it to that stage, plus other money.
Yeah, ideally that would be. And honestly, it's worked less that way now, because I've found that a lot of the distributors say, oh, did you clear all the music yet? And I'll say, well, I cleared what I needed for now. Why do you ask? You know, so I think a lot of, especially traditional distributors these days, really want you to have cleared everything. And that's a great thought. But if they're not advancing any money, which a lot of them aren't, then it becomes, well, what's in it for me here, you know? So it's an interesting time to be sorting through these issues. I really think that it's almost at the point where making these kinds of films is getting prohibitive, because there's not enough funding up front from a lot of the traditional funders, including distributors who in the past might have given you an advance. All that's gone. And now on the back end, people are saying, oh, well, is it cleared? You know, so it makes making this kind of film much more challenging, and it really brings up the whole idea of, you know, where else are you going to get the funds to make a film like this? So,
right. Well, talking about the funds for the film, I remember that you had a really successful Kickstarter campaign, and you used something that was very creative. You had a flash mob. Tell us about that. That was great.
Yeah, we had actually done we did two Kickstarter campaigns. We did a little one early on, just because I wanted to stick my toe in the water and see how that worked. This was in the early days of Kickstarter, and I wasn't entirely convinced that this was everything everyone said it was, but it actually turned out to be a lot of what people said it was, which was great. So a year and a half passed, and we thought, you know, we really need to raise more money, so let's do another Kickstarter campaign. And so we had to come back bigger and better and be doing more interesting things, and you have to, you know, because of the nature of social media and, you know, getting people to pay attention to what you're doing these days, everything's so fragmented, we had to think of creative ways of getting attention. You know, you can't just send out a press release anymore, right? So partway through our campaign, we organized a flash mob that converged on a market. There's a thing called Saturday Market in Portland, where there are craft vendors and food, and there's a big fountain in downtown Portland called the Skidmore Fountain near the market. And we had I think about 40 or 50 musicians emerge from the crowd and start singing "Will the Circle Be Unbroken" very spontaneously in front of the Skidmore Fountain, and then disappear after that. So they were there for 3 minutes. And so we filmed, we had cameras ready, and we filmed everybody doing that. And it was great because, A, it was fun. B, it got a lot of attention locally, and the folks who were participants really spread the word about the video and the flash mob. But we also got picked up by lots of bloggers, and, you know, a lot of media outlets were charmed by the little video and so spread the word about the Kickstarter campaign as a result. I think it really helped us, especially because in Kickstarter campaigns there's traditionally a sort of a downtime in the middle, almost like a little divot in the process where things almost come to a halt and you think, oh my God, it's all over. We're not going to make our goal. And I was aware of that from doing some research and from my past experience with Kickstarter, so I knew we had to do something fun in the middle to keep things going. And so that's what we did, and it did. It helped a lot. So, and now we and you haven't seen the final credits, but we're going to incorporate that flash mob video in the final credits, we decided. So.
Oh, what fun!
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, that's a behind-the-scenes look at money raising. Well done. Well, you also raise money through house parties. Tell us about that.
Well, we had We had a couple of – we had a lot of fundraising parties. We did mostly music events where we would all show clips from the film. We'd have live music. One time we had a Johnny Cash tribute band play at an event. And another time we had a very experienced old-timey music group called Foghorn String Band that played at the event and played an event for us. But the big one we did was actually connected to the Kickstarter campaign because, as you know, with Kickstarter you have rewards that people get when they donate. And one of the levels of reward was that if you donated so much money, you would get to attend a party with Roseanne Cash and her sister Tara Cash. And and so it was a nice cocktail party hosted by the Widmer brothers, who are big microbrewers here in Portland. And Roseanne had been in town doing a concert, and she agreed to come to the event. And she was just gracious and fun to be around, and she met everyone at the party, and people really had a good time, and we showed clips from the film. We had a DJ playing old-timey music. There was lots of good food and good beer and beer from the Widmers, and it was just a really fun event. And what was incredible about it was, it was a thank you, so we weren't really trying to raise more money. I mean, the idea would be great if we could. Roseanne did an impassioned speech about supporting the film, and then we got our biggest donor happened to be at the party, and it was a couple, and they were just so enchanted by the whole thing that, and very big supporters of Appalachian music and film, that they came on board and really made all the difference in finishing the film, which was great. So
blessing.
Yeah, it was a great moment. And I know you predicted. I talked to you before then. You predicted that something great was going to come out of the party like that, and I thought, yeah, maybe. And you were right, Carol. So
I knew it. Well, I think this film has a really long shelf life. I think it's a historical document that will be around for many, many years. So tell us, what are you thinking of for marketing?
Well, we've got a bunch of things in the works. We still haven't started our festival run yet, and so we're looking ahead to that. We've got a couple things already nailed down. Cleveland International Film Festival, which is a venerable film festival, it's been around for 38 years, is going to show it in March. We're going to be part of the Southern Circuit Tour in April, which is a really great multi-city festival with eight filmmakers are selected every year to participate in it, and I'm one of them, and I'll be touring the South with the film. And then we have a screening, probably our premiere will be at the Grammy Museum in Los Angeles later this spring, and that's really exciting. It's just a great venue, and I think it'll be a nice, splashy event. And then we're still talking about, you know, there's we want to do some limited theatrical. We're putting in place now a music museum tour, so we'll show it at the Country Music Hall of Fame, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, Experience Music Project in Seattle, as I say, the Grammy Museum, and hopefully the Smithsonian as well. And so that's part of our plan. And then after that, we're working with a team called Film Sprout in New York to do educational touring, also a public television broadcast, and then we'll be doing DVDs and video on demand too. So we've got a lot of interest. I went to Hot Docs in Toronto in the spring, this past spring, and met a lot of distributors all in one fell swoop, and had a lot of great conversations with people about the future of the film. And so we have a lot of options. I think the tricky part with the market being as fragmented as it is these days is trying to figure out the right partners and the right combination of things and the timing of everything. When does everything happen? And that's a little, you know, it's a little confusing, but it's fun to try to figure out, and I have a good team that's helping me. So I'm really excited about the possibilities ahead. It's looking good.
It is, and it keeps changing. Now films are saying we are day and date, so the VOD happens when they go in the movie theaters. And the question is, does that make more money for the filmmaker, and do we have enough history for you to decide from?
Right. Yeah, I mean, that's what I mean, yeah, by the timing thing. It's very tricky, and you'll get a lot of different opinions about it, too, you know.
I work with filmmakers every day. I know you hear five different sides to a story.
Right. And, you know, and I think with documentaries, since we were talking about its role and how people perceive it, I mean, you know, documentaries don't typically show up that in theaters in that widespread a manner. You know, it's an unusual documentary that goes, you know, across the country that way. But I do think that there's a way to leverage certain screenings, you know, doing New York and Los Angeles and maybe a couple of other key cities and getting reviews and then doing sort of a video on demand thing so that at least the film is on people's radar screens when they go searching for it in video on demand. It's a name they know. So that's a big part of what we're trying to do is build up some name recognition for the film so that when people scroll down their Comcast screen on a Friday night, they go, oh, yeah, there's that film about the Carter and Cash families. Yeah, let's watch that.
Exactly. And let me tell you what, you have to be really quick to notice this, but I was watching some of the Weinstein films that are coming out, and the previews, they were not winners, but they were selected, but they would put four laurel wreaths up there, and it said selected four, but it didn't say they won anything, but it makes it look so prestigious just being selected. That can benefit you. Amazing.
I was going to say, these days, what's really interesting, I mean, the festival thing is so crazy now. You know, Sundance got 12,000 entries this year.
Yeah.
And they only select 187 films. So, honestly, getting selected anywhere is a big deal these days. You know, South by Southwest got 10,000 last year.
My gosh.
You know,
right.
So... It's crazy. So yeah, if you get into a festival, that's a big deal.
All right. Well, maybe that seems like it, but I want to see something. I mean, for me to go to a movie these days, because I love my Netflix download so much, and to get me out of the house, it's got to have won an award. So that's how I think. But
yeah, sure. But well, I mean, then you know you've really got the best of the best, right?
Yep. Exactly right. Well, when you take this tour that you're talking about and throw across the southern state, will you be able to raise more money, or how can you make money off of that tour?
Well, the filmmakers get paid to participate in it. And, you know, I think it's certainly – I've actually been selected for it before for a previous film, my film Blinking Madonna and Other Miracles. And so, you know, there's opportunity to certainly – direct people to donation websites and talk about what needs to happen with a film beyond the tour. So I certainly think of it as a platform for being able to, you know, let people know that we still need to raise money. It's a good thing.
You can't say that. You can, in your speech, say that we're still raising money to release the film.
Oh, yeah.
Good. All right. Well, when you talk about the Smithsonian and the other museums, did you have to put that together yourself?
Yeah, we will be putting it. We're in the process of putting it together now. Yeah. I mean, there are groups that do it. In fact, this group, Film Sprout, that we've been talking with, is a tremendous organization. It's in New York City, and they work with filmmakers to do these outreach campaigns, typically around social issues documentaries. But what's interesting is, you know, we're a little bit outside that definition because we're more of a cultural film, but what they do is try to help you find audiences for your film beyond the typical theatrical or whatever, because there is a great, you know, the educational market is still really good for filmmakers, but it's just a question of, you know, reaching the right people. So they have a great deal of experience in this, and they also not only set up the tours themselves for you, but they will work with you to train your team so you and your team can do it yourselves. Obviously, you save a lot of money that way. And I think it's important because, frankly, I know better than anybody at this point who my audience is for this film. And the kinds of people that have reached out to me in the course of making this film, I've met all kinds of professors, musicology professors, people who teach American studies, people who teach history, people who teach women's studies. There are all these different groups that love being able to show a film that illustrates certain points about what they're teaching. And I'm fully aware of who they are, and I've got a sense of where I can find them. So this group, Film Sprout, is helping me reach out to those universities and sometimes organizations to, plan regionally, to plan appearances where I go at the film, show the film, sell the film to the university. So that's a great market, and I'll be doing a lot of that. So
yeah,
that's the big part of our plan.
Yes, and that's a big DVD sales market too, I would think.
Right.
But getting that connection and knowing the magic words to say to get these people attached to your film, this is where you really do need help. So I'm glad to hear about Film Sprout. I'll research them.
Yeah. Yeah, they're a terrific organization. They're providing us with all kinds of templates, letters. Why reinvent the wheel? I mean, it's something you could probably figure out, but they have done it time and time again. So they give you letters, the letters of introduction, follow-up letters, invoices, spreadsheets to track everything. I mean, it's really an incredible. I think it's a great organization, so they're helping us a lot.
Okay. Well, what's next on the horizon? Do you have another film in mind?
Well, I have a lot of films. Unfortunately, I would say right now, I really want to keep giving this its due. I mean, I think there are other music films down the line for me, and I'm there's also a film I'd like to make. About a Japanese photographer who has a very interesting story that I've been sort of mulling over for many years. It's been incubating, and I'd love to tell that story. But at the moment, I'm working with the public television station here in Portland and doing a photography series for them, and that's been really fun and gratifying and, frankly, a nice break from fundraising. So those are kind of my plans for the moment, but I will get back to this. There are still a lot of women's music stories I'd like to tell. One in particular is about the band Fanny that was the first major all-women rock band to get signed to a major label. And they're not very well known, and the principals are all around and fascinating, and they still play great music, and I'd love to be able to focus on them at some point. So.
Wow, that sounds interesting. But I also like the Japanese photographer.
Yeah, the story of the Japanese photographer is fascinating because he's a man who took photographs around the same time as famous photographers like Edward Curtis, early photography in the West. But this man came to Washington State in the early 1900s and became the photographer for a region and documented not only the settlers, but also the native population. And they're some of the most magnificent photos I've ever seen of people. And obviously, everyone came to love this guy. His name was Frank Matsura. And you can see it in the photos, how much they relate to him, which is the magic of the photos. And he died very young, and he was mourned by all these people. And I just think it's a kind of fascinating story about an outsider coming in. And he was so outside. He was outside the Indian population. He was outside the white population. And he became one of the most beloved figures in the region. And so I just love his story. I'd like to tell that story. So,
well, if you put some of your great music in there, the local music, you would have something outstanding, I'm sure.
Yeah.
That sounds great.
Yeah,
well,
that'd be great.
Tell us how people can reach you, Beth, because this is such a wonderful film and a lot of information that you've shared with us. We really appreciate it.
Well, thank you. there are a bunch of ways. We have a Facebook page, The Winding Stream. We have a Twitter presence, also The Winding Stream. We have a website called thewindingstream.com. And those are probably the best ways to get a hold of us. And if you go to the website, you can also get on our mailing list, and that way we can keep you posted of all the things that are going on with the film, because we send out frequent email blasts about our progress, and now as things heat up, all of our screenings. So,
fantastic. Well, good luck to you, Beth, and thank you so much for this film. It's a major contribution to all of
well,
us.
Well, I want to thank you, Carol, for your support, not only for the support that you gave because of the grant, but the fact that you signed on, you know, that means a lot to other people, other funders, too. So, you know, I really appreciate that, and I appreciate what you do for other filmmakers, too. So thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. How kind of you. All right. Well, this has been a great show, Claire. Thanks for everything.
Yes. Thank you. And Beth, carry on with your work. You're doing a fantastic job, and I know a lot of people are going to enjoy your future projects as well.
Great. Thank you, Claire. Take care.
Okay. Be well, all.
Lots of love. Bye.
I want to remind our listeners that David Raiklin is a brilliant and talented award-winning musician who scores films and can compose music for a trio or for a full orchestra. David is a very good friend to the independent filmmaker and comes highly recommended by From the Heart Productions. If you need music to help tell your story, please contact him at davidraiklin.com. That's David, RAIKLEN.com. And Carol and I want to thank you for tuning in to The Art of Film Funding. Please visit our website at FromTheHeartProductions.com. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter. Good luck with your films, everyone.